So, kia ora, hello and welcome to today's Weber Training Teleclass Lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure today to be able to introduce the South Pacific Teleclass speaker for this month, Ramon Chabon. Sorry, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Ramon. He's joining us from Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia. I had the pleasure of meeting Ramon at the New Zealand Infection Control Nurses Conference in New Zealand last year, and it therefore gives me great pleasure to welcome him today as one of our speakers. Ramon has very impressive credentials in the field of academia and infection prevention. He is the postgraduate programs convener within the School of Nursing and Midwifery at Griffith University, senior research fellow within the Griffith Health Institute at Griffith University, and visiting senior research fellow, Department of Emergency Medicine, Princess Alexandra Hospital in Australia. He's a registered nurse, a medical scientist, and ambulance paramedic with the expertise in emergency primary health care, public health, infection control, infectious diseases, community health, and education. And as if that isn't enough, he's the Australian delegate on the U.S. Association for Professionals in Infection Control, Infectious Diseases Emergency Preparedness Committee, and also an active member of the College of Emergency Nursing Australasia. Ramon has published over 50 scholarly publications. He's a clinical research leader and with the National Health and Medical Research Council, National Institute of Clinical Studies in Australia, and editor-in-chief of the Australasian Emergency Nursing Journal. So like I said at the beginning, very impressive credentials. We're very grateful that you've taken the time out of your really busy schedule to be with us today, Ramon, and are really looking forward to hearing your lecture on the topic of pandemic, public health and emergency care, contemporary trends and new challenges for infection control and infectious diseases. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane. Today I'm going to spend about an hour to share with you some of our current research findings and to explore an emerging area in the discipline of infection prevention and control, and that's which relates to this notion of the intersection between pandemics, public health and emergency care. You would all have received a PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to speak to this as my presentation proceeds. I will indicate when I'm turning from slide to slide. So I'm going to move to slide two now. I'd like to begin by recapping some of our collective goals in infection prevention and control. And at its most basic level, our roles as infection prevention practitioners and specialists, and indeed healthcare workers, is to reduce the risk and spread of healthcare-acquired infections. And that's a fairly broad mandate and one that is fundamental to the quality and safety of healthcare globally. That brings with it many challenges, as I'm sure almost all of you would be aware of. The role of infection preventionists and practitioners, and indeed healthcare workers, is ever increasing, and we often have to work more increasingly in variable contexts. So, we're asked to do many more things in many more settings and with many more challenges. One of the major challenges for us as healthcare workers is to think about how we practice and how we provide quality and safety in healthcare within particular contextual challenges and particular contextual contexts. In terms of infection prevention and control, it's well established that the origins of this are largely hospital-based, and for many, many years, and up until very recently, the focus of infection prevention and control has been focused on hospital-based care, and rightly so. But in recent times, we've moved and expanded the scope of practice to think about hospital-acquired infections or nosocomial infections outside of hospitals, and it's more about where healthcare is provided rather than in a specific facility such as a hospital. And we've moved to this notion of a healthcare-acquired or healthcare-associated infection. And as we know, healthcare is now given to patients and provided often outside of hospital-based settings. And so this whole nexus and this whole divide between hospital and community-acquired infections has really become quite an issue for us in this discipline. And it's this nexus where I think particular challenges that present themselves more and more increasingly of interest to our work as infection preventionists and in infection prevention and control. The challenge of where healthcare is delivered is something that we need to think carefully about in our day-to-day work. On to the third slide. Emergency care is one of these challenges where, it's one of these contexts where the challenges of infection prevention and control, and indeed healthcare, is well established. What is it about emergency care that makes providing care to patients more and more challenging? And what does this mean for our work in infection prevention and control in terms of managing infection and managing communicable diseases? Well, as the next slide does show, the challenges are many, and these, again, would be familiar to many of you as healthcare workers. This is just a short shopping list of some of the challenges, but in terms of emergency care context, some of the challenges that stand to mind are time. Emergency contexts are time-pressured, high-stakes environments where there are large numbers of patients who present at all hours of the day. The acuity of these patients varies considerably from those who require immediate resuscitation to those who have relatively minor conditions and complaints, which can be seen at different timelines. There's poor levels of predictability in terms of when patients will present and what kinds of illnesses and their clinical profile that they have when they will present to emergency care contexts. And indeed, because of this, emergency departments and other emergency care settings often have to have what we coin the terms of rubber walls, where we may in fact have a 30-bed facility, but we have vastly increased numbers of patients than we have beds. The loss of uncertainty in emergency care, given that it's a high-pressure to high-stake environment where there was lots of uncertainty about the nature of patients' illnesses and complaints. Emergency care healthcare workers often have limited previous assessment, treatment and diagnosis information about their patients, whereas a general practitioner may have this history of a patient. Patients often present brand new to a facility and the staff are unaware of them completely. Patients always seem to come in and never go out, and that's resulted in a whole lot of issues with respect to issues such as ambulance ramping, access block and overcrowding. And it's these issues with overcrowding in particular, an access block, which I'll raise later on, that present particular challenges for infection prevention and control. This context leads to challenges in communication, and these are more than just about language. It's about the way in which communication and information is passed around and disseminated and the timeliness of it. Expectations that patients have of their healthcare, and indeed the expectations that healthcare workers themselves have of what they can deliver given the finite resources. Emergency care settings such as EDs have to respond to disasters, and those are both internal and external. And you know, these might be events within the hospital. And I guess fundamentally, there's a whole variety of other settings and other resource issues that we have to contend with. And finally, we're open all hours, so it's a one-all shop. And the list goes on. So on the next slide, I've listed some of the hot topics that emergency care settings are faced with in more recent times, and these are, again, of no particular, not to any of you. Bioterrorism, particularly with organisms such as anthrax, the way in which wounds are managed and multi-drug-resistant organisms, the shifting of patients' care from hospitals to community-based settings. Patients often bounce back to hospitals via the emergency department. Gastrointestinal diseases such as norovirus in particular plays huge havoc with the emergency departments and emergency care settings. Most topically and most recently, influenza and other respiratory infections such as SARS, community-acquired pneumonia, and in 2009, the pandemic of H1N1 was really, in our short history, has really polarised and demonstrated the challenges that present healthcare workers in emergency care settings. On the next slide, I've talked about the fact that pandemics are nothing new. They're nothing new to us on this planet as a society, as a race, and I've listed there some of the more recent pandemics in the last century. But I think it's fair to say that the pandemic of 2009, which was H1N1, or coined as swine flu, presented some particular challenges that we hadn't been previously privy to. And that is that, it, certainly in fact in Australia, emergency departments became the forefront of the response in many ways to this infection and this outbreak, and they had a primary public health response in the way in which we dealt with H1N1 across the country. Moving on to the next slide, when H1N1 was first recognised and the outbreak was established, the Australian government elected to respond to the disease at that stage and the infection through its pandemic network, and it declared H1N1 as a health emergency. So this brought about a whole variety of media campaign and public health messaging that essentially directed patients who thought they were suffering from this infection to an emergency department or to their GP for initial treatment and or healthcare. And on the next slide, what this meant was that emergency departments across Australia were basically inundated with patients. There were hundreds of patients who attended EDs around the country, and the Colleges for Emergency Medicine and Nursing noted that this had anecdotally a significant impact in the function of the EDs, who are ordinarily busy with many other patients and other emergencies. And so the National Health and Medical Research Council called for an urgent research forum into H1N1, and a group of colleagues and myself were successful in that application for the grant, and we undertook a study to examine the impact of H1N1 pandemic in 2009 on emergency departments across Australia. Moving on to page, the next page. So just to give you some of the brief background to the pandemic, the first case in Australia was documented in Queensland, and rapidly following May 9, cases began to emerge in Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia, and indeed every other state and territory in the country. On May 29 of 2009, some of you may remember that the cruise ship the Dawn Princess, travelling from Hawaii to Sydney, had passengers on board with influenza-like illness, and the New South Wales Health Department requested delays and the quarantining of this particular ship until public health officials could actually assess the patients on board and determine if isolation was required. And so that triggered, the response of Australian healthcare systems to the response nationally. On the next slide, on the 11th of June in 2009, the World Health Organization escalated the level of threat of the pandemic from 5 to 6. This was, in many ways, the turning point for the national and international response to H1N1 over time. Moving on to the next slide, in view of that, as I said earlier, emergency departments are at the forefront of Australia's disaster health response, and they provide immediate patient care and enable system-wide patient facilitation of care across hospitals and across networks. The pandemic H1N1 in 2009 presented EDs in Australia with many challenges relating to the roles that they were to undertake in managing this particular outbreak from their perspective. And it provided us with an opportunity in terms of the emergency medicine and nursing community and those of us in infectious diseases and infection control to explore the impact and the way in which emergency departments functioned in dealing with and responding to the pandemic at that time. And this was, I think it's fair to say that this was probably the first time that a pandemic of this size has had such a response by emergency departments in Australia. And so The aims of this study were to, on the next slide, to describe the impact and clinical profile, including severity, of patients presenting with two Australian emergency departments with influenza-like illnesses during the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic. Moving on, as I said, this was a National Health and Medical Research Council urgent call for research. And so our three specific research questions were to, one, describe the number and clinical profile of patients that presented to Australian EDs with ILIs during April to August 2009, including the patient outcome. It was to explore and to describe the management of these patients within the EDs and the wider hospital-based setting. And thirdly, to look at the impact of the outbreak on EDs with a specific emphasis on the way in which special precautions were adopted and or required, what changes occurred to the way in which emergency departments are practiced, if any, the changes and the impact on staff support and staff welfare and protection, and in particular to look at the impact of the influenza pandemic on staff absenteeism, because as I'm sure you all would be well aware, there is lots of literature that talks about how pandemics, in particular those and other health disasters that are bioterrorist and biohealth related, has an impact on staff absenteeism. Moving on to the next slide. So our methods were, it was a two-part study. Part A was a national survey of the directors of emergency medicine of all teaching hospitals across Australia. And unfortunately, this yielded a poor response from the directors of emergency medicine, and we had insufficient data to analyse anything of great substance. And that, I will just comment on, that was largely because certainly in Australia, each state and territory operates under different, or they operate using different data systems, and it was virtually impossible for us to gather the data and to have it collated and analysed in a universal system. But the more successful element to the study was Part B, where we did a national survey of Australian emergency nurses and physicians by the membership of the three colleges for emergency medicine and nursing in Australia. We had a response rate of 18.4%, which is actually pretty good considering the fact that this was an urgent call for research. And when I say urgent, just to give you some background of the timelines, the grants were called for in April. They had to be due in May. They were decided upon in June. And we had to report back in December of that year, which is a six-month timeline. And by any definition, that's extraordinarily short. So although the 18.4% response rate could be better, I think that given the nature of the instance, we did quite well. And we've got some interesting findings from this study based on those responses. Moving on to the next slide, which is titled Results. This slide just gives some of the background in terms of the demographics of the participants. The clinicians were a relatively young bunch with a median age of 38 years. The median years of experience as a clinician was 12 and the ED experience was 8 years overall, suggesting that patients move into emergency departments and emergency care settings early in their career. Most of the respondents worked full-time. 66% of the respondents were medical staff and 36% were female workforce participants. 33% overall of the respondents were nursing staff, and not surprisingly, 83% of these were female, which reflects the national average in Australia. All states and territories were represented. And when we looked at the individual's employment, most of the participants worked in public hospitals and the majority were in large capital cities. Onto the next slide. Some of the individual characteristics, and I've focused on two groups in the results here. One as specifically on nurses, and then one group as the entire participant pool. The characteristics of the nurse respondents show that most worked in clinical roles as either registered nurses or as a senior clinical nurse, and that includes a whole variety of titles such as clinical nurse specialist and clinical nurse facilitator. Around one-fifth of those who worked, of the participants worked in nursing management, there's a nurse unit managers and above. And there were very few nurse researchers and nurse practitioners, which again reflects the demographic of nurse researchers and practitioners across Australia. Australian emergency nurses were incredibly well qualified in this study sample. 54% of those who responded held a graduate certificate or graduate diploma, 26% held a master's degree, and 1% held a doctoral degree, which is well and truly above the national average in terms of qualification base for nurses. On to the next slide. Moving on to the specific results about the impact of the pandemic on emergency departments. There was quite divided opinion about the level of preparedness of the emergency departments, both across the respondents and indeed within nurse respondents themselves. Almost all respondents felt that the ED demand had significantly increased during the H1N1 influenza pandemic, and almost half of the respondents and nurse respondents felt that the H1N1 influenza pandemic had a significant impact on the care of other patients in the ED. And that was one of the key influencing drivers for this study. We were well aware that indeed most departments in Australia operate at capacity or over capacity ordinarily. And along comes a pandemic of national proportion, international standards. And so we had, as I said earlier, we had large numbers of patients presenting in droves to departments around the country, to the point where some facilities were calling formal disasters, a code brown response, and going into disaster mode purely because of the staging of the numbers of patients who would then present. On to the next slide. As many of you would be aware, we are fortunate in some regards that the majority of patients who presented with ILIs and H1N1 did not sustain or experience significant morbidity and or mortality, which was one of the great concerns when the pandemic first emerged. And in fact, we asked the participants about how well or not they viewed the patients that they experienced were. We used some key terms like the worried well, which is a dreadful term, but it's one that reflects the context in emergency care. And indeed, the majority of respondents felt that patients who presented were the worried well, and there were some patients who were moderately ill, and those who, of course, were critically ill and ended up on ECMO. Most respondents, including nurse responders, perceived that the majority of ED patients were worried well, and that the numbers of patients who were critically ill were, in fact, quite low. On to the next slide. We asked the participants about the usefulness, coverage, and consistency of information provided to them during the H1N1 influenza pandemic. And again, opinions were quite divided. Most respondents and nurse respondents in particular felt that the information provided was usually useful, and that the coverage was generally quite sufficient. There were, however, quite divided opinions about the level of consistency of the information, and there were many anecdotal reports reported in the survey in free text comments that suggested that, in fact, the information changed constantly in many different settings, in many different contexts, which made their interpretation of what would be legitimate from what would not quite difficult. On to the next slide. We also asked participants about their organisation's disaster and pandemic plans. As you would all probably be well aware, when SARS struck, that triggered in many ways many departments and hospitals to implement pandemic plans. And so the H1N1 epidemic or outbreak was really, in many ways, the first time that hospitals were able to test these plans in any sort of anger. And in fact, what the study discovered was some 42% of the respondents and 34% of nurse respondents did not know if their organisation had a plan, which is somewhat astonishing. Most of the respondents and nurse respondents knew when their organisational plan had been activated, and those that did know that it did exist thought it worked well. But there's a large proportion of healthcare workers and respondents who did not know that there was a plan specific to pandemics. This led to, among other things, to stress within staff. And on the next slide, I've got some of the findings that report the impact of this pandemic on staff stress and their staff well-being. We asked about staff stress during the H1N1 influenza pandemic, and most respondents and nurse respondents agreed that it was a time of increased personal stress, mostly due to the increased demand for service delivery within the department and increased patient and family aggression. Nurses perceived higher levels of aggression than medical staff, and I suspect that most of this is due to the fact that the aggression may have been experienced by triage nurses who are in many ways the first person that patients who present to EDs actually have to attend to. And so the triage nurses would triage them with a category 4 or 5 on the triage scale, which means that they are seen to within some hours rather than immediately. On to the next slide. There were other sources of stress explored, including the stress of access block within the hospital to intensive care units and to other wards, and indeed the effect of overcrowding in the ED. Interestingly enough, in these responses, ICU access did not seem to be a major problem. And I think that's because hospitals were very good at being able to clear intensive care units and make available additional beds and high dependency beds, given that it became quite clear early on that there were a small group of patients who, for whom the illness was quite serious and required resuscitation via ECMO. However, most respondents and nurse respondents in particular agreed that ward access block and ED overcrowding definitely increased. On to the next slide. There were many anecdotal reports about staffing problems during the H1N1 influenza pandemic, and about half of the respondents and nurse respondents agreed that there were increased staff deficits during this particular period. Most respondents and nurse respondents were not redeployed, and I'll come back to redeployment in some following slides. Opinions were quite divided amongst the respondents about the extent of skill mix issues during H1N1 and the pandemic, and this was about their level of self-preparedness as to how well experienced and knowledgeable they were about pandemics and infectious diseases and infection control to carry out their function in an emergency department. Moving on to the results for staffing, most respondents and nurse respondents indicated that they were not requested to work extra shifts, nor were they asked to work outside their areas of expertise. Less than 40% of the respondents and nurse respondents were asked to staff flu clinics, and this seemed to affect overall nurses more than it did physicians in this particular survey. Only 8% of staff were redeployed. However, redeployment occurred more often in nurses than it did in the case of physicians. Most redeployments occurred for operational reasons rather than staff risk factors for serious illness as a result of H1N1 influenza, such as a pregnancy and obesity. And so this notion of having to redeploy staff to a flu clinic was a key finding of the study and one of the key ways in which many departments managed the pandemic operationally, which I'll come back to later on in the presentation. On to the next slide, we examined staff concerns about their level of risk and exposure to developing and contracting H1N1. More than half of the respondents and nurse respondents were not concerned about personal illness or family exposure during H1N1 influenza pandemic, which was interesting given the much touted and widely publicised concern about the infection at that time. The majority of participants in this study did not report being concerned about them being susceptible to this particular infection. On to the next slide. About one third of the respondents and nurse respondents reported developing an influenza-like illness during H1N1 influenza pandemic. And of these, over 80% of the respondents and nurses did not seek testing. And this was a really interesting dimension to the study. As you would be well aware, certainly in Australia, we stopped testing for H1N1 during phase six, and made it difficult for health authorities on an epidemiological level to gather continuing data about their relative influence and the incidence of the infection at that point in time. Moving on to absenteeism, although there were increased staff deficits reported by these respondents, prolonged sick leave was uncommon. 40% of overall respondents and 20% of the nurse respondents did not take any days off for personal illness. And the average number of days off for personal illness was 2 across the entire respondent pool. And so what this tells us is that those who did work worked almost the entire time, and there were very few or very little absenteeism reported due to staff illness, which is interesting given that over one third of the respondents reported developing an ILI, and yet very few took days off, and those that did take days off, they took maybe 2 or 3 days at best in terms of their sick leave. Time off work to care for others was not a major issue reported in the findings of the study, and the average number of days off to care for others with influenza-like illnesses was 3 for respondents and 3.5 for nurse respondents. There's a lot of talk in the literature about the impact of pandemics and health-related disasters on staff availability to respond to pandemics, and this study suggests that in terms of the emergency department context, this was of very little significance to their practice. On to the next slide, again on absenteeism. There were many anecdotal reports and reasons for absenteeism during the pandemic illness. And as the literature tells us, there are lots and lots of reasons why staff may elect to be absent during health-related disasters. But in this study, most of the documented reasons for absenteeism were of little direct importance. That is to say that the reasons why those few staff who were absent from work, their reasons did not largely marry up with what we know in the literature about the common reasons for staff absenteeism during pandemics. Namely, in particular, concerns about exposure to an infection and to a disease. So staff weren't particularly concerned about that, certainly in this particular sample. On to the next slide. Finally, we asked the individuals whether people thought that H1N1, the influenza pandemic, was in fact a health emergency, and whether or not EDs should take responsibility for managing H1N1 in that particular context. Interestingly, the opinions were quite divided in this. 44% of the overall respondents and determined that H1N1 was a health emergency, but 43% disagreed with that statement. So there was somewhat of an even balance between those who thought it was a health emergency from those that thought it was not. Of the nurse respondents, 48% of those agreed that it was a health emergency and 39% disagreed. Two-thirds of the respondents and nurse respondents did not think that EDs should be responsible for managing H1N1 influenza overall. And I think when we looked at some of this data more closely in terms of the qualitative data that was available in the survey responses, I think this was mostly about the fact that the vast majority of patients who did present with ILI and H1N1 did not present with significant morbidity or mortality relative to those numbers of patients who they do see in the ED on a routine basis. So I think that was a comparison between the patients that they do see normally from those that they did present at that time with ILI. On to the next slide. And so this study led to, and these findings led to a whole variety of lessons and recommendations for the way in which emergency departments certainly participate and manage pandemics and infectious diseases outbreaks as they occur. Firstly, there is a need for a single authoritative source of information that is well regarded. Consistent, timely, accurate messaging is required to avoid confusion. which is more likely to cause injury to patients and adversely impact ED staff. Many of the free field comments from participants reported, reflected a request for us to adopt, in Australia at least, a CDC kind of model of information dissemination. So we have an Australian Office of Health Protection which performs these functions, but what they're calling for is a CDC style where it's a national response and communiques are issued routinely. The second lesson and recommendation was that information should be provided in an organised and consistent format, regardless of the means of distribution. Multiple means of information dissemination are necessary, but consistent messaging is vital. As you would recall, staff reported that they received lots and lots of information from lots of different sources, but in fact, that information was contradictory, particularly around the levels of precautions that were required to manage these patients and what might need to be done at a specific work practice level in the ED for them to carry out their work in a safe and quality way. A simple state-of-the-art summary that's issued and reissued regularly is one of the answers to that, and that's certainly what the CDC does provide in terms of their bulletin outbreaks. The third lesson and recommendation was that there's a need for active engagement and collaboration with the media and for clinicians to aid in the process of this information sharing. I think it's fair to say that when the pandemic broke, the media took to it with great frenzy, which they will argue is certainly their role and their responsibility. But the results from this study suggest that, in fact, the way in which this pandemic was communicated to the general public created alarm and the mixed messaging from a whole variety of sources had an impact on the way in which patients then sourced assistance and help from facilities such as emergency departments. Appropriate communication strategies are needed to reflect local engagement and they need to be cognizant of the need for consistent information. The fourth lesson and recommendation was that there is a need for standardised clinical approaches and guidelines. Guidelines need to be issued, and in the case of pandemic H1N1, the guidelines that did exist around pandemic responses and the way in which influenza is managed were found to be very, very useful. Standardised approaches to triage are necessary to ensure that patients who do present to the ED are consistently assessed and managed. One important point to note here is that at its most basic level, influenza-like illnesses are not traditionally those kinds of conditions that would rate a high triage score, meaning 1, 2, or 3, to be seen urgently unless, in fact, the infection was systemic and the patient had serious morbidity. And so, generally speaking, it's not uncommon to have in ordinary calendar years where we have outbreaks of general influenza, large numbers of patients who have influenza who wait in the waiting rooms for some hours and in fact days to be seen because they're not actually given a triage scale that warrants them to be seen sooner rather than later relative to other patients who require emergency care, such as those who are in respiratory arrest. And so I think there's some work to be done around the way in which we recognise pandemic influenza and the way in which triage processes can cope with the demands for patients in those particular settings. The fifth recommendation was that policies regarding the establishment of flu clinics should be in place. And that should enable them to be deployed rapidly should an outbreak occur. This was a key finding of the study. What was found when we looked at the data quite closely, we could look to see which participants came from particular settings. Some hospitals and EDs opened flu clinics where patients who presented with ILIs were assessed outside of the ED or in a particular area of the ED, and then those who were deemed to have significant illness, such as those who had respiratory depression, were then triaged and moved through the ED for urgent care. And so this staging of patient assessment is one of the ways in which healthcare workers manage disaster responses ordinarily. If there's a disaster in the community, such as a road traffic crash, a bus or a train crash, and there's multiple patients, the standard response is to set up a field site where patients are initially triaged and coded, and then they're transported to facilities based on their initial triage category. And I think the findings of this study suggest that that kind of approach may be useful in pandemic responses where there are large numbers of patients who require care, and they have to go to fixed numbers of facilities for that care, which are overwhelmed by the demands for service. The sixth lesson and recommendation was that ED design should be reviewed to determine how to best accommodate patients who have an infectious disease during a pandemic, and indeed on an everyday basis. There was much talk and much concern, many emails and phone calls to my office and to those of my colleagues about how, in fact, they should manage patients who present with an ILI. Did they need to be quarantined, isolated? What kinds of precautions needed to be used? And, in fact, this led to a lot of confusion about how patients with ILI should be managed. And so part of that is about how the ED is best designed to cope with patients who present with an infectious disease that is communicable by droplet or, indeed, airborne transmission, and how they can then best meet those patients' needs given that particular context. Seven, on the next page, there was a need to have ED infection control procedures reviewed, and I'll talk a bit more about that later on in the presentation. Number eight, there's a range of occupational health and safety issues that need to be addressed on behalf of emergency departments, and this is in particular to leave, immunisation, infection control and entitlements to compensation. Although very few staff were concerned about themselves being at risk to the infection, there were a small number of staff who were gravely concerned about the infection being having an impact on them personally and their family, and they were really very unsure about their exposure and what entitlements there were to in terms of leave during that time. This was on the back of a lot of discussion at the time, in Australia at least, about the need for departments and states to implement mandatory reporting for work. And so it raises the issue about, well, you know, how exposed are staff to within these work settings, and what kind of support and protection can we offer them. Number nine, clinic supplies are required during a pandemic, and that these must be available readily and be in stock routinely. Many departments are reported running out of basic supplies such as face masks and gowns and gloves, and while we were able to rustle up other supplies, it demonstrated the need for us to consider stockpiling and the way in which these stockpiles are managed, certainly in terms of the vaccine, which is another issue altogether. Standard policies are required for the use of PPE and antiviral agents. There was much concern in the responses from participants about when antiviral should and should not be used, what kinds of PPE should be indicated and what shouldn't. And in an environment where the infection becomes somewhat ubiquitous, some of the staff reported feeling that it didn't really matter what kinds of PPE they used. Their exposure might in fact be inevitable. And that might certainly be the case for some kinds of pandemics where the virulence of the organism is usually much more significant or different than perhaps that was the case for H1N1. Number 11, there is a need for us to create in emergency departments strategies to improve surge capacity. And surge capacity is the ability of the department to respond to an increase in demand and service at any given moment. And so this is classically where, to go back to our other example of a disaster, a road traffic crash, if there's a bus crash and there's 45 patients, that would represent a surge demand. And so there are policies for us to use to implement and to enact when there are those kinds of surge demands. But when there's a surge demand that is sustained, such as a pandemic, those policies don't work as well. And so there's need for some work to be done around the way in which policies can be reflected to cope with surge capacity that is more than just one event that will last one or two days. On to the next slide, number 12. Peer and local support strategies should be developed and to ensure that staff needs are met, and thereby creating level of resilience, dependability and stability in the ED workforce. Many of the respondents did report that having their leaders and their managers and their internal staff actively engaged in the response to the infection was really very helpful, and many of them provided additional support services to staff throughout. Number 13, there's a need for us to review planning frameworks to clarify the relationships between pandemic plans and disaster plans. And this is an interesting dimension because, in fact, what I think this study and this experience showed was that a disaster plan ordinarily is something that we can define in emergency departments as being tangible, but pandemics are one of those kinds of instances where they may or may not be a disaster. We think of disasters in a particular way, as I said, motor vehicle crashes, other kinds of events, whereas pandemics haven't usually been on our horizon about whether or not a pandemic constitutes a disaster or not. Some facilities did initiate disaster procedures when the pandemic struck, and others did not, and that's to do with differing definitions. Finally, there's a need for us to recognise that departments in Australia have limited capacity to respond to such measures, given the existing issues around ambulance ramping, access block and overcrowding. And so there's a need for us to tailor the role that departments will have during pandemics to ensure that service delivery can continue. Many of the staff did, as I said earlier, reported that they were concerned about the impact of the pandemic on other patients in the department and those who did not have ILIs. On the next slide, I've just posted some information here that a colleague of mine, Associate Professor Terry Rebin, published in May of 2009 in a paper titled APIC's Role in Emergency Management, Proceedings from the 2008 APIC Emergency Preparedness Mini-Summit. And in this paper, Professor Rebin identified the gaps in emergency management and emergency care when it comes to infectious diseases. And interestingly enough, the gaps that this paper and this study report in many ways exactly what was the experience of H1N1, certainly in Australia. There's much confusion and lack of guidance for community settings. Healthcare providers require additional education and so forth and so on. So this experience of H1N1 in Australia mirrored in many ways the way the findings of this study, and it reflects an emerging area in both emergency care and infectious diseases and infection control that we need to start thinking about into the future. Onto the next slide. Professor Rebman has offered some important components for emergency management plans that require infection prevention and control input. And she talks about particular patient management issues that have infectious diseases implications and the input for us as infection control practitioners into those processes. And so moving to the last slide, I think the central message for us from this experience was that the future for pandemics and public health is certainly interesting. Pandemics are a matter of course. I think it's fair to say that it's not a question of if, but more so when. We have many lessons to learn from H1N1, and one of our greatest concerns in infectious diseases and infection control is that with the ever-increasing antigenic shift of influenza and other viruses, we are concerned about the changing epidemiology of influenza and ILI infections and indeed the associated morbidity and mortality. I think as the findings of this study suggest, many of the patients who did present to the departments did not have significant morbidity and mortality. But if we were to look to a different kind of scenario where, in fact, the morbidity of the of an influenza, if a new entity, of a new strain of it, was to be different and much more serious, and we were to have a higher mortality, then I think we would have much more serious implications on the way in which we respond to these disasters and these pandemics at a healthcare system level. It was an issue in this study and for these participants that it seemed to be that the infection was ubiquitous, and certainly in a pandemic situation where the disease is highly communicable, where there are large numbers of patients who present to emergency departments, it's very difficult for staff to protect themselves from the infection using existing standard precautions and transmission-based precautions. And so it brings to us, brings to question in our minds whether or not pandemics are, in fact, health emergencies and how we will work to define these into the future. It also brings to mind the need for us to reconsider what we define as being a disaster to be more than just an instance where there is a physical event such as a bus crash or a train crash or even terrorism and bombings. And pandemics, certainly in this experience, did equate to a form of disaster, and which meant that it had an impact on the way in which patients were managed in those particular settings. It raises questions around community models of care for future pandemics and the whole notion of a flu clinic. I suspect that if indeed, if future pandemics, if patients have higher morbidity and mortality, then the experience of this study and of 2009 H1N1 will see the establishment of flu clinics in the communities to act as staging areas. And it presents fundamentally many challenges for us in emergency care into the future.
Thank you very much for that. I think that was a fascinating insight into many of the issues that, you know, internationally we faced as well with that pandemic. I was particularly interested with your reference to the flu clinics, because that was certainly an approach that we took locally here in Canterbury, which really was aimed at having that initial community response and taking the pressure off our ED. So that worked extremely well for us. As the research was commissioned by the Health Research Council, do you have any feedback as to how many of your recommendations are actually going to be taken on?
Well, the report went to Council late last year, and so the Health Protection Office is currently going through those recommendations at the moment. And from what I've last heard is that all recommendations will be considered by Council, which is good news. This study was one of, I think, 26 that were commissioned overall, but the only one that actually looked at health service delivery in this particular context. So it's interesting times ahead.
Yes, isn't it just? Yeah, lots of lessons for all of us from the whole pandemic response, I think. And certainly your suggestion as well about re-looking at our modelling around our plans, I think it's an important one for us to take forward as well. So thank you very much for that. As usual, for you, the listener, if you would like to put any questions to Ramon by email, please don't hesitate to send them to me. My email address is on your handout, and I'll certainly make sure that they get forwarded on to Ramon. In closing, I'd like to thank Ramon very much for his contribution to this year's teleclass series in the South Pacific. We really appreciate it, and I hope that we can keep in touch with you and hear of any further research activities that may be of interest to you, to us rather, in this series. So thank you, the audience, for listening in, and don't forget that you can access any of the other Weber teleclasses by registering via the website, listening to them live, or via the rebroadcast. Thank you all very much for joining us. I do look forward to talking to you again in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.